Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshat Shemot. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's Parsha is Parshat Shemot. I would like to begin with the Ramban, Nachmanides' introduction to the book. He refers to the book of Shemot as the book of exile and redemption. Normally, we think of exile and redemption in geographical terms. Exile being associated with the Jewish people leaving the land of Israel. Redemption, returning to the land of Israel. In the beginning of the book of Shemot, we in fact have the description of Yaakov and his sons coming down to Egypt, leaving the land of Israel. But the end of the book of Shemot does not describe the entry into the land. In fact, the entry into the land does not even occur at the end of the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy. It only happens in the book of Joshua. Nachmanides knew his Chumash very well. And now I would like to quote you his language, translated, and see how Nachmanides understands exile and redemption, not in geographical terms, but in existential ones. And he says the following, and I'm beginning in the middle of his introduction. When they went down there, meaning to Egypt, this is the beginning of the exile. And the exile is not completed until the day that they return to their place. To the status of their forefathers will they return. When they left Egypt, although they left the house of bondage, they were still considered to be exiles, because they were in a land not theirs, confused in the desert. But when they came to Mount Sinai, and they built the tabernacle, and God returned and caused his presence to dwell among them, then did they return to the level of their forefathers, who in fact were the chariot, and then were the Jewish people considered redeemed. And therefore, the book concludes with the construction of the tabernacle and with the glory of God which fills it always. If I were to paraphrase the words of Nachmanides, exile and redemption are existential terms. Leaving God, the disconnect between a person and God, is a state of exile. The more that one is alienated from God, the more they are in a state of exile. Returning to God, or in the language of Nachmanides, God returning to the person, dwelling in their midst, is the expression of redemption. Before I explore this any further, I would like to examine this theme in a number of places in the book of Bereishit. The first example of exile is at the end of chapter 3 in Bereishit, in the Garden of Eden story. God expels Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. He places two cherubs east of the garden, with a double-edged sword, who guard the path to the tree of life. Adam and Eve are not only sent out of the garden, they are cut off from the tree of life. But on a more profound level, they are cut off from God, the source of life. That is reflected by God no longer speaking to them, walking among them. As we see earlier, in chapter 3, verse 9, when God calls out to Adam, and when God speaks to him, and when God walks among Adam and Eve in the garden. And this theme is developed further in chapter 4. After Cain kills Hevel, Cain kills his brother Abel. And God says the famous words, "Where is your brother?" And the response being, "Am I my brother's keeper?" God then curses Cain. And he says to him in chapter 4, verse 12, "You will be a wanderer in the land." And Cain's response in verse 13 is, "My sin is too great to bear." But even more so in verse 14, "Behold, you have driven me out of the land today, and I will be hidden from your face." And the way that should be understood is that Cain feels he is now disconnected from God. God is no longer going to look after him, to protect him. And God's response is to give him a sign that reflects a certain level of protection. And one last example, the beginning of Parshat Vayetze. Jacob is leaving the land of Israel to go find a wife, to go to Haran. And we discussed this in a previous podcast. The geographical move reflects an existential move. Jacob is very afraid, and God appears to him in the famous dream of the ladder with the angels going up and down. And the message of that dream is, although you are going to the Galut, I will be with you. Jacob is afraid that leaving the land of Israel means he is leaving God. Or perhaps God is leaving him, abandoning him. And therefore God's message is, I will be with you. And when Jacob wakes up, he says, "How awesome this place is. I didn't know that in fact God was here." These are a few examples that illustrate that the physical, geographical reality somehow reflects the existential reality, but is not identical to it. In other words, we have discussed in previous podcasts, the patriarchs actualized a very intense relationship with God in the land of Israel. When they leave the land of Israel, that relationship is very much in the background. It still exists, but it is no longer up front. God does not speak to them. God has other ways of communicating with them. But as we see in the Ramban, it is possible to be outside the land of Israel and be in a redeemed state, as reflected by the Jews when they received the Torah at Sinai and subsequently construct the tabernacle. I would like to develop this idea in another way. In Hebrew, we refer to this book as the book of Shemot. And on the Pshat level, Shemot has to do with the names of all the children of Israel who came down to Egypt, which are the opening verses of our parsha. But I would like to suggest something else. The essence of this book revolves around the names of God, which reflect the idea of exile and redemption. And what do I mean by that? When we look at the first chapter, first two chapters of our parsha, the name of God does not appear, with two exceptions. The first exception is in chapter 1. The name of God appears with respect to the midwives. We're told in chapter 1, verse 17, "And the midwives feared God. They did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do. They keep the children alive." And subsequently, in verse 20 and then 21, "And God did well with the midwives. The people increase, they become very powerful. Because the midwives feared God, he made for them homes." The second reference at the very end of chapter 2, in the last two verses, in fact, 2.5 verses, the name of God appears 5 times. Chapter 2, verse 23. "And their cry for help went up to God from the work. And God heard their cry, and he remembered the covenant he had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the Jewish people, and God knew." Note that the name of God which appears in both of the references that I gave is Elohim. So that in the beginning of the book of Shemot, either God's name is absent, or when it appears, it is the name Elohim. But when we turn to the end of the book, chapter 40, from verse 34 on, we see the following. "And the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of God fills the tabernacle. And Moses could not come into the tent of meeting because the cloud dwelled on it, and the glory of God filled the tabernacle. When the cloud would go up, the children of Israel would travel. But if it did not go up, they would not travel. For the cloud was on the tabernacle by day, and the fire was there at night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel in all their journeys." The name of God which appears at the end of the book is the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God. And not only that name, but it says, "Kvod Hashem," the glory of God. And the very end, the last verse of the book, "before the eyes of the Jewish people in all their journeys." The movement in the book of Shemot, the movement from exile to redemption, is a movement from a reality where God's name does not appear, or if it does appear, it is Elohim, to a reality where it appears in all of its glory, Kvod Hashem. And perhaps a turning point in the book that really reflects this change, this shift in names, is in next week's parsha. In Parshat Va'era, in chapter 6, verse 2. Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe, vayomer elav ani Adonai. Elohim speaks to Moshe and says, I am Adonai. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the name El Shaddai, but the name Adonai was not known to them. The whole movement of the book is from Elohim to Adonai. As Shakespeare said, what's in a name? We have noted in a previous podcast, Elohim in rabbinic literature is associated with the God of nature, as God is manifested in nature. Elohim is a hidden God, because one could say this is nature. The four-letter name of God has to do with the idea of the one who creates being, a supernatural God. And if I use the words of the end of the book, it's associated with the glory of God. The glory of God, which is visible to the eyes of the house of Israel. The movement of the book is from a reality of exile, where it seems that God is not there, to a reality where God is in your face, where there's absolutely no question of the existence of God and of the presence of God in the midst of the Jewish people. But in fact, in the beginning of the book of Shemot, where God's name does not appear, is God really absent? And I would like to look at a very interesting pasuk. Chapter 1, verse 7. After the Torah describes those who came down to Egypt, it says, and Joseph and all of his brothers and that whole generation died. And then it says in verse 7, and the children of Israel were fruitful, and they swarmed, and they increased, and they were powerful, very much. And the land was filled with them. And I would like to do an exercise in examining what the Midrash says about this, and what, quote-unquote, the Pshat people say about it, and show you how the Midrash and the Pshat, to a great extent, come to the same conclusion. Rashi, on this verse, relates to all the different words which are being used to describe the increase of the Jewish people. And he quotes a Midrash which says that the Jewish women would have sextuplets, six babies at a time. What's it based on? Rashi quotes it on the word which says, Vayishritsu. They were like vermin. In the same way that vermin have multiple births. That's how the Jewish people were. Why six? There are six words describing their reproduction. Paru, one. Vayishritzu, two. Vayirbu, three. Vayatzmu, four. Bimaod, five. Maod, six. If we take this Midrash at face value, there is something totally extraordinary which is happening over here. That Jewish women are having six children at a time. It's not normal. Supernatural. Rashi's grandson, the Rashbam, considers himself to be the Pshat person. And now let me give you his running commentary. It says, the children of Israel paru, which means they became pregnant. Vayishritzu, which means they gave birth. Nobody miscarried. And maybe if I backtracked, I could add, nobody had trouble becoming pregnant. But then it says, Vayirbu. Those children who were born then grew up. And in the words of the Rashbam, there was no infant mortality, but they grew up to be young men. Vayatzmu. Vayatzmu. They didn't die as young men, but on the contrary, they were very, very powerful. Ma'od, ma'od. Very much. Until the whole land was filled with them. Which means that according to the Rashbam, we're describing the process of how the Jewish people now become a nation. Women are becoming pregnant. Women are then actualizing the full-term pregnancy, giving birth. The babies born grow up to be young men. The young men are robust young men. And ma'od, ma'od, this isn't just happening in one case. This is happening across the board. There's a population explosion. If we step back for a moment, we can see that the way the Rashbam describes the growth of the Jewish people is no less miraculous than the way Rashi did. And ultimately, it's the deeper meaning of the verse. Because in fact, how do you go in a matter of a few generations from 70 souls to a few million people? And the answer is, because of divine intervention. Although God's name is not mentioned in this verse, it should be very clear that what's going on here is something extraordinary, supernatural. And I might even add, it is God's actualization of the promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will make you into a great nation. Ironically, the actualization of that promise did not happen in the land of Israel, but outside the land of Israel. So that although the Jews are outside the land of Israel, God is very much alive and well with them, intervening in their reality, actualizing the promise that he made to the Jewish people. It would be a mistake to say that when they leave the land of Israel, they have been cut off from God. So where is the exile? At the end of verse 7, it says, Vatimale ha'aretz otam. The land is filled with them. The pshat is that the people have become so numerous that they completely fill the land of Goshen. By the way, note, this has echoes of the first chapter of Bereshit, when God says to Adam and Eve, Peru, Rivu, Mil'u et ha'aretz, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. Here are the Jews, paru, vayirbu, vatimale ha'aretz, and the land is filled with them. But note the fact that it is filled with them, not actively filled, passively. Timale is in the passive form. Which land is filled with them? Well, the Jews are living in the land of Goshen. So that the Jews have now filled the land of Goshen. But it would seem to be that maybe, in fact, it's not just the land of Goshen, but it goes beyond the land of Goshen. That, in fact, the whole land of Egypt is filled with Jews. There is a very interesting midrash quoted in Yalkut Shimoni, which says, what does it mean the land is filled with them? The circuses, the theaters, and if we put it in modern terms, the government offices. Every single place of Egyptian life is filled with Jews. This midrash is fascinating. What it's saying is, when the Jewish people have this population explosion, and as a result of that, the Jews go beyond the ghetto walls of the land of Goshen. Not only do the ghetto walls break down physically, but existentially. And what do I mean by that? Rather than the Jewish people acknowledging their reality as being an act of God, and as a result of that, embracing God, embracing their identity as Jews, when the moment comes that the Jewish people are finally becoming the Jewish people and are experiencing the promise of God to Abraham, I will make you a great nation, the response of the Jewish people is to assimilate in Egyptian culture, to abandon God, which therefore means if God's name is not mentioned in the beginning of the book of Shemot, it is not because God is absent. God is there. But the people are not acknowledging God's presence. To perhaps phrase it differently, it is the people who create for themselves the state of Galut. It is not that God has left them, but they have left God. And the people put themselves deeper and deeper into Galut. Not only do the Jews not acknowledge God, the Egyptians, Pharaoh, does not acknowledge God. With one exception, the midwives who fear God. In the midst of a reality where it seems that God is absent from the consciousness of everyone, the midwives stand out as being very much aware of God. And not only aware of God, but that awareness creates a fear of God. A fear of God, which is not fear in the sense of punishment and reprisal, but fear in the sense of awe, in the sense of being accountable. The midwives feel that their accountability, their allegiance is to God rather than to Pharaoh. And because of that, they cannot kill Jewish babies. And then we're told in chapter 1, in verses 20 and 21, that God did well to the midwives. God enables the people to increase and become powerful. He gives the midwives homes. So that if God was in the background in verse 7, God comes to the forefront in verse 20. When people bring God into the reality, God is then more openly manifest in the reality. Note that the basic reward which God gives the midwives is to bring their actions to fruition. If the midwives tried to save Jewish babies, God empowers them, helps them succeed, increases the people, and makes them very powerful. Only secondarily does God give them their own homes. The basic reward is enabling a person to succeed in what they did. And when we go subsequently at the end, and look at the end of chapter 2, the process of redemption for the Jewish people begins when the people cry out for help. Note the fact that in chapter 2, verse 23, it never says the people cry out to God. They just cry. They cry in pain. They recognize that they need help. They don't even know where to turn. But their cry for help goes up to God, and God listens. God will not respond to the enslavement of the people until the people realized that they're enslaved, until the people realize they need help. And even if they don't know where to turn, their cry will go up to God, and God will come in rapid succession and become involved. The people create the galut. The people create their redemption. People can drive God out of their reality, and people can bring God back into the reality. One of the ironies of our parsha is that when things are going exceptionally well, rather than acknowledging it as being an act of God, people go in the other direction. And it is only when they are in the depths of enslavement and suffering that they begin to realize that they need some power force beyond them, and then invite God back into their reality. Exile and redemption are in our hands. The story of the book of Shemot is that God wants to be near us, but we have to want that. And when we want it, we can ultimately bring about a reality where the glory of God fills the tabernacle, where the presence of God is before the eyes of the house of Israel. May we merit to experience redemption and bring God back in full force in our reality. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.